downtown Austin, Texas, and Rich was on working with him for 7 years, teaching and discipling and ministering college students and other things, and then was over in Louisiana for a couple years, and then came over to Birmingham to pastor a church there for the last 7 years. Has four children, 13 down to 8.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Boy and three girls. But I, before I met Rich, through this common friend who's from out in Austin at the time, I heard about Rich and read some articles he wrote. Rich has done a lot of writing over the years, written a book on children and their place in the covenant and life of the church, and has written a lot of articles, added contributions to books on a lot of different wide range of topics, reviewing books and commentaries and a lot of other scholarly kind of work, biblical theological work. Rich is, if I could think of anybody, and the reason I asked for Rich to come up tonight, it was Mark's idea originally, because Richard Hunscheid, Mark's son, is in Rich's church down in Birmingham. And Mark had been down there, he's been down there numerous times for worship, and heard Rich talk about Constantine, the Roman emperor, and just the role of the church and Christian faith and engagement in the culture. And Mark came back a couple months ago here and said, man, we got to get Rich up here to head a house with me just to talk about these things. But then, and I was easy to convince, because there are few people I can think of that I would rather have their influence on our body and in our community than Rich. Just his influence of how he reads the Bible, how he sees the church, what is the nature of the church, how the church impacts its community, how a church functions internally in terms of God's work and worship and the sacraments and discipling and shepherding, all those things. Rich, I've sent out a link to their website, and on their website, Trinity Presbyterian Birmingham, there's tons of stuff and materials that Rich has written over the years, and tapes, and I mean, it's all fantastic stuff. Rich is a great theologian, great historian, great churchman.
Boy, Stuart, this is going to be tough to speak tonight after this.
And so I'm thrilled.
Nowhere to go but down now.
Well, I don't think so. I think you'll fulfill it all. But, and I have... we've got a room over there. So I've looked forward to this. We tried to figure out how to get him here. And, hey,
I'm sure you know the same venue. Just throw back here.
So what I want to do is Psalm 20 is part of the Bible reading from this past week.
Right, yeah. Sure, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's
if we're going to hold those fixed anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, thank you, Stuart, for that introduction. Like I said, there's no place to go but down now. What Stuart didn't tell you is his role in my infamous attempted transfer into Evangel Presbytery, where Stuart was my advocate, and I went down in flames. That's when I learned how much pull Stuart. That's when I learned how much pull Stuart had in the presbytery. I thought he was the man. It is great to be here with you tonight, and really enjoyed getting to know Stuart through the years, and of course greatly appreciated his ministry and all the things I hear that are going on up here, and having Richard and seeing the Hunscheid family occasionally is great as well, and all that. They've always got great things to say about what's going on here. So Stuart's been a very encouraging friend in the ministry, in the pastorate, which is a very valuable thing, what I want to do tonight, it was really Mark Hunscheid that originally talked about doing this with me, and he did talk about me coming and speaking on Constantine and Constantine's historical role in the rise of Christendom, that kind of thing. So I'm going to do that. What we're going to do tonight is, I guess what I would call a political theology, for lack of a better term, or Kingdom of God theology. But along with that, I want to talk about the place of the church in the public square. I want to talk about what we as Christians should hope for out of politics, how we should see ourselves living out our calling in the world, in the culture, in the creation, how we can play our role in discipling the nations as God has called us to as the church, and the role we play in the growing of God's kingdom. Ultimately, it's God himself who has to build his kingdom, but God is in us. God, through Christ, through his Spirit, dwells in us, and so he makes us agents and instruments in the growing and building of his kingdom, and so we'll talk about those kinds of things here tonight. And I want to use Constantine as my test case, as my jumping-off point. Constantine is a very controversial figure today, the first Christian emperor of the Roman Empire. He's a very controversial figure today. Not everybody thinks that it was a good thing that Constantine became a Christian, believe it or not. I take a very classic view of his role in history. I believe that he was genuinely, though imperfectly, converted, which I think describes all of us, right? That's where all of us are. So certainly he made his share of mistakes, but I do believe he was a faithful Christian. I think once we clear away the myths and the legends that have accumulated around Constantine, we are left with a very helpful model of what a Christian statesman should look like, which I think can be helpful for us in our own context. And so I want to briefly talk about how Constantine was converted. I want to talk about the aftermath of that, which will give us some insight into how Christian civilizations grow and mature. And I also want to talk about, and this is what I'm really going to focus on at the end, what led to Constantine's conversion. What made his conversion possible? What is sort of the precondition of another Christendom? If that was Christendom 1.0, and now that's fizzling out and coming to an end, it appears, in our neck of the woods, our part of the world, what would Christendom 2.0 look like if God gives us another Christian civilization, which I trust that he will? As I said, Constantine's not a real popular figure today. In fact, Constantinianism is really a slur. It's a way of describing what went wrong. The church was pure and faithful, and then Constantine came along, and it got all mixed up into politics and all that, and it got corrupted, and it was all downhill from there. I would guess with this group, I don't have to convince you that that's a misguided view. The kingdom of God is not some invisible reality that's just tucked away in our hearts. Certainly the kingdom of God does rule in the hearts of men, but the kingdom of God also takes root in cultures, in societies, in civilizations, and in an imperfect way, but also in an anticipatory way, can be seen in the cultures, in the nations of the world today. So the kingdom of God is, as Jesus said, like leaven, working its way through the whole batch of dough, permeating it, bringing transformation. Doesn't happen all at once, happens bit by bit, but Constantine was part of that leaven. We're called to be part of the leaven as well, leavening that whole lump. So Constantine, on October 28th, 312 AD, Constantine's army clashed with the army of Maxentius near the Milvian Bridge in a famous battle just outside of Rome. At that time, Constantine was the emperor in Gaul and in Britain, while Maxentius ruled over Italy. Constantine marched towards Rome to overthrow a man he believed to be a tyrant. Constantine's army emerged victorious when a pontoon bridge collapsed under Maxentius' soldiers, and Maxentius himself drowned in the Tiber River. And so the next day, Constantine marched into Rome carrying Maxentius' head on a spear. And from that time forward, there was no question who the emperor was. No, he was the undisputed ruler of the entire empire from that time on. But what is of most interest to us is what happened on the eve of that battle. Some of you may know this story or some version of it. Up to this point, Constantine had been like most of the other pagan rulers before him. He was a very capable man, a great military mind. He was very insightful, but he was also very ruthless and very pagan. However, unlike some of the other pagan emperors who preceded him, he was very skeptical of the empire's off-and-on policy of persecuting the church. He did not think persecution would be effective. In fact, his father, Constantinius, had been rather lenient with Christians in his realm, although being persecuted in other parts of the empire. And Constantine himself had continued that policy. On the eve before his battle with Maxentius, Constantine knew that he needed divine help to win. He knew that the Roman army was calling on every form of magic and incantation against him, that they were calling on their pantheon of pagan gods to help them in battle. Constantine was a very religious man, and so he knew he needed supernatural help, and so he began to pray. And according to the historian Eusebius, who says he got the story directly from Constantine, Eusebius tells us about noon, when the day was already beginning to decline, he saw with his own eyes the trophy of a cross of light in the heavens above the sun, and bearing the inscription, "Conquer by this," or "In this sign, conquer." Eusebius goes on to tell us that Constantine's entire army saw this sign, not just Constantine, but the rest of the army, and they were all struck with amazement at this miracle. As a result of this vision in the sky, Constantine had his soldiers mark their shields and their helmets with the cross, or actually it seems with a Cairo, which is a symbol of Christ himself. Now, it's hard to know exactly what to make of this. Obviously, these kinds of visions and dreams, some kind of sign like this in the heavens, these are things that a lot of times it's easy to be skeptical of. And we can ask the question, as historians usually do, is this a private dream or was this a public vision? Again, Eusebius tells us that others in the army saw the cross in the heavens, and that when Constantine related the story to Eusebius, he sealed his account of it with an oath, that this is what really happened. Lactantius, who was another close associate of Constantine, calls it a dream, that Constantine had a dream in which he saw the cross and the message "in this sign, conquer." Whatever the case, something happened. There is no other way to explain the sudden change in loyalty that Constantine experienced and that his soldiers did as well. To deny that something happened would be like denying that George Washington crossed the Delaware. You know, if he crossed the Delaware, how did he defeat the British? How did we free ourselves from British tyranny? You know, it had to happen. There's no other explanation. And obviously, something had to have happened. In a deeply religious culture, as that culture was, it was simply impossible to change the symbols on the soldiers' equipment the way that Constantine did without something radical happening, because those symbols on their religious, on their military equipment were not just symbols, but they were ways of invoking the powers of the deities. That's how they saw it, of course, at that time in history. The military standards, the banners that they used as they marched into battle were not just symbols, but were actually religious objects that would be venerated and often even had powers ascribed to them. So to change those symbols was to change the gods that you're calling on to help you in battle. And to do so on the eve of such an important battle was simply unthinkable unless there was some very powerful justification for it, such as a sign in the heavens or some kind of message from God, as it were. Some have said that perhaps what Constantine saw was a natural phenomenon of a kind of sun halo, is what it's called, that may be a way of explaining what he saw. Whatever the case, when Constantine consulted with Christians about what he saw, you know, this light encircling a cross, looked like a cross and crown together, Christians said, "What else can this be but a sign that Christ himself is the Lord? This is the God that you should call on to help you as you go into battle." And the fact that Constantine was converted on the eve of this battle, that apparently many of his soldiers were as well, and then he went out and won this decisive victory, did wonders for the reputation of the Christian God in the Roman Empire, and of course the reputation of the church as well. And Constantine showed after this that it was a genuine conversion. There was a real heart change, a change of loyalty. He began to replace pagan symbols on buildings and on coins with Christian symbols. He slowly stopped invoking the pagan gods and using pagan titles for his own position. Prior to the year 312, he honored Apollo and Sol, the sun god. After 312, he honored Christ as his god. And some have said, well, surely this was just a matter of political expediency. Constantine could see that the church was growing, and so, you know, it's sort of like, you know, picking the winning racehorse halfway through the race. He laid all his money on the church, and that's who turned out to be the winning horse. No, that doesn't account for what happened. It was really not politically expedient for Constantine to become a Christian. The church certainly had grown from the time of the apostles to the beginning of the 4th century, but there was certainly no political advantage for Constantine to choose the Christian God as his own. If anything, it was a very risky move politically because so many leading Romans still treated the church with suspicion and even hostility and contempt. It was also counterintuitive for Romans to treat the cross as a sign of victory, which of course is what Constantine was doing, to treat the cross as a sign of kingship. In the Roman mind, as you know, you're familiar with even just you see in the New Testament, it was the crucifiers, not the crucified, who should be honored. So to say that this man Jesus, who was crucified by the Romans, is actually in some way lord over the Roman Empire, was a radical step on Constantine's part. Now, of course, Constantine was still what you would call an immature Christian, theologically and practically, but he did begin to reshape and refashion his empire, laying the foundation for what became known as Christendom, a Christian civilization that flourished for almost 1,500 years, a Christian civilization that Christian culture, even in our part of the world, must trace its roots back to. What are some of the things that he did? Constantine, of course, did not have any ready-at-hand models for Christian statesmanship. Oh, sure, there had been emperors who had been converted before. We might think of Pharaoh in Joseph's day, or the king of the Assyrian Empire in Jonah's day, or Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel's day. But Constantine, in many ways, was entering into an unprecedented situation as a Christian emperor. There's no question that Constantine did implement several very salutary reforms. He ended, of course, the persecution of the church, and in fact granted freedom to all. And it's very interesting. If I had more time, I would go into some of the details in his writings, and I did this actually when I taught on this history. Very, very interesting. He does not begin a counter-persecution against the pagans. Instead, what he says is, now that I am a Christian, I'm granting freedom of religion to all. An unprecedented move. And in fact, we would not have our concept of religious liberty. You know, we trace our concept of religious liberty, you know, back through the American Revolution and to some things that happened in the Reformation with the development of a covenantal and representative understanding of government and back from there to the Magna Carta. And a lot of times that's as far back as we go. But really, we need to keep pressing all the way back to Constantine and especially to sort of one of his right-hand men, Lactantius, who did a lot of the thinking about this as a Christian political theologian. This is where religious liberty comes from. We take it for granted that any civilized society is going to practice religious freedom, at least to a certain degree. But that was really unheard of at the time. He reformed the legal and economic systems in the empire, leading to greater honesty in business and more dignity, especially for the marginalized, for women and children, protecting them from certain ways in which they had been vulnerable to oppression. Of course, he called the Council of Nicaea in 325, which was to unite the church. He had a great desire to unite the church. The early church was not nearly as united as sometimes we think it was. There were actually a lot of factions, a lot of divisions by this time in the church, and he called Nicaea because he wanted the church to be united. And of course, what came out of that was the Nicene Creed, which did, at least for a time, unite the church not only in faith, but in government as well. I have called Constantine's overall approach missional theocracy, not two words that get put together normally. We think of a theocrat as somebody who's going to persecute everybody who doesn't agree with him, and we think of mission, obviously, as seeking to persuade others to come into the faith, come into the kingdom. But I think actually with Constantine you see what a true missional theocracy looks like. In his Edict of Toleration, he did not seek to impose the Christian faith on his subjects. He knew that would backfire. He knew that adoration of the true God, adoration of Christ, could not be forced. People would have to choose freely on their own to come to faith in Jesus. But he did carve out space for the church to carry forward her mission, space for the church to evangelize, space for the church to have all kinds of influence in the culture, which obviously had not been the case before. He carved out space for the church to carry out her assigned task of discipling the nations. In that sense, you could say his policy is really what opened the door to the Christianization of the empire. Now, obviously, only God can raise up Christian rulers of this sort, and I think we ought to take great comfort in the fact that it was not a matter of the early church using its political clout or political power to get the right man into office. They had no political power, they had no political clout. Instead, as what's happened so often in the biblical narratives, God took a pagan ruler, and through the faithful witness of his people, God converted that ruler. And that's what you see happen again and again in the scriptures. And I think that so often we think, oh, well, we can only change things if we get the right guy in power. But it's just as easy for God to change the heart of the man who is in power. I think we can learn a great deal from the history leading up to Constantine's conversion. This is what I really want to focus on, this question. How did the early church pave the way for his conversion and the eventual Christianization of the empire? The discipling of the West, what we call Western civilization, which is the best example we have of what a Christian civilization should look like. Not perfect by any means, all kinds of flaws, because of course we Christians are still sinners. But the best example we have of a Christianized civilization, how did it happen? It happened both from the top down and from the bottom up. It happened from the top down with Constantine and then with his Christian successors. He was instrumental in guaranteeing to the church the freedom to carry out her mission. And as she fulfilled that mission, of course, that's Christian civilization sprang out of that. But before that, before his conversion, I think is when the real battle for the empire was won. When Christian martyrs shed blood for the sake of the gospel in the Colosseums and arenas of Rome, that's when the real battle, it's not the Milvian Bridge, that's not where the real battle for the empire was won by the gospel, by the church. It was really when Christians faithfully shed their blood for the sake of the gospel in the Colosseums and arenas of Rome. I think there are three main things that the pre-Constantinian church did that we can learn from. I think in some ways, and a lot of theologians have called attention to this, a lot of church historians have called attention to this, the fact that there are a lot of parallels between our situation now, living in what is now largely a de-Christianized, heavily secularized society, a lot of parallels between our situation and the situation the church found herself in before the conversion of Constantine. And so I think we can learn a great deal from the church of that era, and especially three areas I want to point out tonight. Worship, mercy, and vocation. First, the Christians were uncompromising in their worship of Christ as king. Ask yourself this question, why were the early Christians persecuted? Why were they seen as such a threat to the Roman Empire, to the stability of the empire? At this point in history, you know, even by the beginning of the 4th century, you really only had about 5 to 10% of the empire that had converted to Christianity. So the Christians were a very tiny minority. Why were they considered so dangerous? Why were they considered subversive traitors who had to be singled out for persecution? Well, it's because it was so obvious, so publicly obvious, they would not play along with emperor worship, the emperor worship that was required in that day. Rome did not care who you worshiped or what you worshiped, so long as you also worshiped Caesar. And so most pagans had no problem worshiping Caesar right alongside all of their other gods, but not Christians. There was actually even a point in time where Caesar actually asked if Christians would want to add Jesus to the pantheon of gods, to the pantheon of Greco-Roman gods that they already had. And of course the Christians said no, because Christ is unique. Christ alone is to be worshipped with the Father and the Holy Spirit, one God existing in three persons, and your pantheon is just a parody of the Trinity, our one God who exists in three persons. This is the only true God. We worship him alone. And I think in many ways we have the same kind of issue today with political correctness, with pluralism, with multiculturalism, with relativism. These are all ways in which the culture, the powers that be, say to us, hey, it is fine for you to worship whoever and whatever you want, so long as you will also burn a pinch of incense to the gods of diversity and tolerance. That's really what we're up against, and in many ways it's very similar. The early church was actually classified as a political society, not that they really sharply distinguished between politics and religion, but that's how they viewed the church, that's how it was classified more like, say, Israel than some kind of what we might think of as a sort of private club. The church was seen as a threat for this reason. It was seen as an alternative political order. Christians were actually called atheists because they refused to worship the familiar gods. And of course, they were called cannibals because when they gathered, they did some kind of strange ritual where they ate the flesh and drank the blood of their leader, apparently. You know, all kinds of confusion about what was going on there. But that's how Christians were viewed. In the same way, when the world around us figures out what we're really about, we're considered oddballs and misfits and even political subversives. If you don't play along with the diversity police in a lot of segments of our culture today, you will be accused of homophobia, racism, bigotry. You'll be viewed as a terrorist, as a threat to the peace, a threat to the stability of the regime. Now, thankfully, Christians in our day have not had to suffer. You know, for us living in the Bible Belt, we are largely insulated from some of the from some things that go on in other parts of our country where Christians have had to pay at least some kind of a price for their faith already. But if you look at the trends, if you look at the trajectory that we're on, without some kind of intervention, which certainly God could do, if you look at the present course of things, it's hard to see how we can avoid suffering. Even today, I was just reading an article this afternoon about it's somewhere in Kansas. There's a law that's up that would require churches to perform same-sex unions on their premises because homosexuality is going to be treated as a protected class like race. And just as you can't discriminate at people with a different skin color, you can't discriminate against people of a different sexual orientation. Now, it may be that law will get passed and get struck down, but that won't be the last time it happens, and that's what's being pushed. That's what's being pushed more and more on us, and you have to think that if present trends continue, at some point, that's what we're going to be up against. The early Christians, because they worshipped Christ above all, because they were so utterly committed to worshiping Christ above all, they were willing to suffer. They found in Christ one who was worthy not only of their worship, but because he was worthy of worship, he was also worthy of their suffering. They were willing to pay a price for their faith. The early Christians believed that their suffering was a prelude to victory. And that's why, as best we can tell from the ancient liturgies we have, even during times of great persecution, the liturgies of the church were completely triumphalistic, talking constantly about the victory of Christ when here they are, this tiny, beleaguered minority that's being persecuted by the empire. And yet all they can do is talk about victory. You know, you look at modern Christians today, and we sit in our easy chairs with a remote control in one hand and a beer in the other, watching TV, just complaining about how bad things are. And they were really suffering, and all they could talk about was Christ's triumph and Christ's victory. Do we share their faith? Do we share their commitment to Christ? I think we have to ask ourselves some hard questions here. The early Christians believed that their suffering was a prelude to victory. Just as the cross of Christ led to his resurrection, so they believed that their suffering would yield fruit. It would yield results. It would bring transformation. The church would suffer and serve her way to victory. Here's one story that David Chilton tells in his book, Days of Vengeance. In Nero's Circus Maximus, the scene of his bloody and revolting slaughters of Christians by wild beasts, by crucifixion, by fire and sword, Nero would slaughter Christians just for entertainment, you know, even if he wasn't mad at anybody at that moment. In this Circus Maximus, there stood a great stone obelisk, silent witness to the valiant conduct of those brave saints who endured tribulation and counted all things as loss for the sake of Christ. The bestial Nero and his henchmen have long since passed from the scene to their eternal reward, but the obelisk still stands now in the center of the great square in front of St. Peter's Basilica, so it's been moved. Chiseled on its base are these words taken from the Overcoming Martyrs Hymn of Triumph, Christus vincit, Christus regnat, Christus imperat, which being translated means Christ is conquering, Christ is reigning, Christ rules over all. The early Christians were triumphant in the face of suffering because they worshipped Christ above all. They didn't worship their own comfort, their own convenience, their own coolness. They worshipped Christ above all. I think the question we need to ask ourselves in our present situation is, do our worship forms the forms we use in worship prepare us for this kind of suffering? Do our worship forms give us this kind of confidence? Do they prepare us for this kind of warfare? You know, if you're about to be thrown to the lions, and all you know are songs that make Jesus sound like he's your girlfriend, that's not going to get you ready. You're much better off knowing the Son of God goes forth to war, or rise again, ye lion-hearted, or King Alfred's war song. Do our worship practices lend themselves to Christian mission, when carrying forward that mission would bring all kinds of suffering? See, for the early Christians, it was really their worship that fueled their mission. They worshiped Christ alone. Christ alone is King. And so, therefore, it's not enough for us to just worship him in the cozy confines of our sanctuaries. We've got to go out and proclaim his lordship and live out his lordship in every area of life. Let me read something to you from N.T. Wright, who captures this really, really well. Long quote, but it's golden. He says, Christianity did not spread by magic. It is sometimes suggested that the world was, so to speak, ready for Christianity. Stoicism was too lofty and dry. Popular paganism, metaphysically incredible and morally bankrupt. Mystery religions, dark and forbidding. Judaism, law-bound and introverted. And Christianity then burst on the scene as the great answer to the questions everyone was asking. There's a grain of truth in this picture, but it hardly does justice to the historical reality. Christianity summoned proud pagans to face torture and death out of loyalty to a Jewish villager who had been executed by Rome. Christianity advocated a love which cut across racial boundaries. It sternly forbade sexual immorality, the exposure of children, and a great many other things which the pagan world took for granted. Choosing to become a Christian was not an easy or natural thing for the average pagan. A Jew who converted might well be regarded as a national traitor. Even slaves who might be supposed to have less to lose than others and hence to appreciate an elevation of status through conversion might face a cost. As we saw, plenty thought it normal to interrogate with torture slave girls who happened to be part of the early Christian movement. We have no reason to suppose that interrogation under torture was any easier for a young woman in the 2nd century than it is in the 20th. Why then did early Christianity spread? Because early Christians believed that what they had found to be true was true for the whole world. The impetus to mission sprang from the very heart of early Christian conviction. If we know anything about early Christian praxis, it is that the early Christians engaged in mission, both to Jews and Gentiles. The irresistible expansion of Christian faith in the Mediterranean world during the first 150 years is the scarlet thread running through any history of primitive Christianity. This missionary activity was not an addendum to a faith that was basically about something else. Christianity was never more itself than in the launching of the world mission. This is clear from the sources we've already mentioned. Justin, so these are early Christians and non-Christians. Justin tells us of his meeting with an old man who talked to him about Jesus. Pliny speaks of the poison of Christianity spreading into villages and countryside. Ignatius finds churches wherever he goes throughout Asia Minor. Tacitus, in the tone of voice of one who has come across a dead rat in his water tank, comments that all the worst features of world culture find their way to Rome sooner or later. And if we look for a moment at the canonical writings, we find them full of mission. Matthew's Jesus instructs the disciples to make disciples and baptize all the world. Luke's Jesus commissions his followers to go to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. And John's Jesus says, as the Father sent me, so I send you. The story of Acts is the story, or rather a story, of early Christian mission. And whatever we may think about the portrait of Paul in Acts, the letters confirm that not only he, but a good many other Christians believed it their business to travel around the known world telling people that there was another king, this Jesus. World mission is thus the first and most obvious feature of early Christian praxis. And I would say that mission, that sense of mission, flowed out of their worship. John Piper has that great line where he says, mission exists because worship does not. It's because we worship Christ and we want to see Christ worshiped everywhere. It's because we worship Christ as Lord and we want the whole world to acknowledge that he is Lord. It's because we want the whole world to know who he is and his greatness. It's because we want the whole earth to be filled with the glory of the knowledge of the Lord that we carry out mission. Worship fuels mission. So we have to ask, if the upward call of worship is our highest priority, We can't help but be driven forward and outward in mission to the world. We want Christ's lordship acknowledged everywhere. One more quote here about this. Leslie Newbegin says, "The church is an entity which has outlasted many states, nations, and empires, and it will outlast all those that exist today. The church is nothing other than that movement launched into the public life of the world by its sovereign Lord to continue that which he came to do until it is finished in his return in glory. It has his promise that the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. In spite of the crimes, blunders, compromises, and errors by which its story has been stained and is stained to this day, the church is the great reality in comparison with which nations and empires and civilizations are passing phenomena. The church can never settle down to being a voluntary society concerned merely with private and domestic affairs. It is bound to challenge, in the name of the one Lord, all the powers, ideologies, myths, assumptions, and worldviews which do not acknowledge him as Lord. If that involves conflict, trouble, and rejection, then we have the example of Jesus before us and his reminder that a servant is not greater than his master." It makes me think of that line from Chesterton where he says that Jesus promised his followers that they would be absurdly happy and constantly in trouble. It's a good way to think about the Christian life. So that's one area, worship, and especially worship as it fuels mission. We want to see Christ acknowledged as Lord everywhere. But another area where I think we can learn a great deal from the early church is if we look at mercy ministry. The church must be an agent of mercy, an instrument of God's mercy in the world. Here, I don't know if any of you have read any of Rodney Stark's recent books that he's put out over the last several years, but Stark is a sociologist and historian who I think has become a Christian through the course of all of his research and studies. But he asked the question, how did the early church grow so quickly and overtake the empire? You know, if you were laying odds, you know, in Las Vegas and you looked at, you know, the 12 guys minus one who betrayed Jesus, you know, lined up there in Jerusalem, you know, after, you know, the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus, you wouldn't have guessed that these guys would take over the world, you know, without ever firing a gun or raising a sword or anything of that nature. It just would seem unthinkable that it could happen, and yet it did. And Stark asked the question, he poses the question, you know, how could this have happened? What made the Christian faith so remarkably attractive that it caught on and spread like wildfire? This is what he says. Again, I'm reading a lot of quotes here, but he says this very well, so I want to give this to you. It says, "Let me merely suggest here that Christianity revitalized life in Greco-Roman cities by providing new norms and new kinds of social relationships able to cope with many urgent urban problems. To cities filled with the homeless and impoverished, Christianity offered charity as well as hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis for attachments. It offered community. To cities filled with orphans and widows, Christianity provided a new and expanded sense of family. To cities torn by violent ethnic strife, Christianity offered a new basis for social solidarity. And to cities faced with epidemics, fires, and earthquakes, Christianity offered effective nursing services." Stark tells the story of how when plagues would hit particular cities, all the pagan doctors would flee the city, you know, and a lot of the pagan political leaders would flee the city too. And the Christians would stay behind and care for the sick, care for the dying, sometimes at great risk to their own personal health. They would stay behind and help. And after the plague was over and everybody came back into the city, of course, everybody wanted to be a Christian. They had never seen anything like this. People who were not afraid of death, because death loomed over the ancient world, Christians had no fear of death because they believed in the resurrection of Jesus, that life conquers death in Christ. They'd never seen this kind of mercy displayed before. Made the church very attractive. This is what he goes on to say. "Christianity brought a new conception of humanity to a world saturated with capricious cruelty and the vicarious love of death. We learn the details of the long ordeal and gruesome death suffered by this tiny band of resolute Christians. These were games held in honor of the birthday of the emperor's young son. The issue is spectacle for the throngs in the stadia watching people torn and devoured by beasts or killed in armed combat was the ultimate spectator sport worthy of a boy's birthday treat. Christians effectively promulgated a moral vision utterly incompatible with this casual cruelty of pagan custom. Finally, what Christianity gave to its converts was nothing less
than their humanity. You know, if you're familiar with The Hunger Games, the book that's out now, the movie's out, I guess. I mean, that whole premise. I mean, the ancient Roman Empire was even more brutal than that, and Christians and others were put to death just for the sake of entertainment. And Christians stepped into that world and opposed it with an altogether different moral vision, a moral vision that caught on because of the way they lived it out. One problem that we have here, and this is something I know that Stuart has really emphasized a lot, deficient theologies of the kingdom have kept us from developing mercy ministries like Christians of the past. The reason that the early church developed these kinds of mercy ministries is they believed in a holistic salvation, that God's kingdom would touch and renew and transform every part of human life, that the whole cosmos ultimately would be renovated and rejuvenated and transformed and transfigured through Christ. We've lacked that theology for a long time now, and the result is our practice, our Christian practices have been sorely deficient. Let me give you another story here. This comes from actually my birthplace, Laurel, Mississippi. This is about what took place during the Civil Rights Movement. Story of a Baptist pastor, well-known Baptist pastor in the 60s, Reverend Marsh. And Laurel, Mississippi was also the hometown of Sam Bowers, who was the imperial wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And, of course, terrorized African-Americans throughout the region. This telling of the story is from the book When Helping Hurts. Bowers was suspected of plotting at least 9 murders of African-Americans and civil rights workers, 75 bombings of African-American churches, and numerous beatings and physical assaults. How did Reverend Marsh, the model Christian in the community at the time, respond to this situation? This is his son Charles explaining what happened. "There's no doubt my father loathed the Klan when he thought about them at all. In his heart of hearts, he considered slavery a sin, racisms like Germany's or South Africa's, an offense to the faith, and he taught me as much in occasional pronouncements on Southern history over homework assignments. There's no justification for what we did to the Negro. It's an evil thing, and we were wrong. Nevertheless, the work of the Lord lay elsewhere. The daily installments of Mississippi burning, the crushing poverty of the town's Negro inhabitants, the rituals of white supremacy, the smell of terror pervading the streets like a Masonite stench, did not figure into his sermons or in our dinner table conversation or in the talk of the church. These were, to a good Baptist preacher like him, finally matters of politics, having little or nothing to do with the spiritual geography of a pilgrim's journey to paradise. Unwanted annoyances? Yes. Sad evidences of our human failings? Certainly. But all of these will be rectified in some eschatological future when we all get to heaven. What a day of rejoicing that will be." And then this is their commentary on the story. Reverend Marsh had reduced Christianity to a personal piety that was devoid of social concern emanating from a kingdom perspective. He believed Christianity consisted in keeping one soul pure by avoiding alcohol, drugs, and sexual impurity, and by helping others to keep their souls pure too. There was little now of the kingdom for Reverend Marsh, apart from the saving of souls. For Reverend Marsh, James 1:27 said, "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless as this, to keep oneself from being polluted by the world." Somehow he overlooked the phrase that pure and faultless religion includes looking after orphans and widows in their distress, which is also in that verse, James 1:27. While Reverend Marsh preached personal piety and the hope of heaven, African-Americans were being lynched in Mississippi through the plotting of Sam Bowers. Less dramatic, but even more pervasive, was the entire social, political, and economic system designed to keep African-Americans in their place. What would King Jesus do in this situation? Would he simply evangelize the African-Americans saying, "I've heard your cries for help, but your earthly plight is of no concern to me. Believe in me, and I will transport your soul to heaven someday. In the meantime, abstain from alcohol, drugs, and sexual impurity." Is this how Jesus responded to the blind beggar who pleaded for mercy? Reverend Marsh did play a role in the civil rights movement, but it was not to seek justice, encourage the oppressed, or to defend the cause of the fatherless, or plead the case of the widow. Instead, he focused his attention and energies on the lack of personal piety and unbelief of some of the civil rights workers. This culminated in his writing a famous sermon, The Sorrow of Selma, in which he lambasted the civil rights workers, calling them unbathed beatniks, immoral kooks, and sign-carrying degenerates who were hypocrites for not believing in God. Now, this is the really important part. In one sense, Reverend Marsh was right. Many of the civil rights protesters longed for peace, justice, and righteousness of the kingdom, but they did not want to bend the knee to the king himself, which is a prerequisite for enjoying the full benefits of the kingdom. In contrast, Reverend Marsh embraced King Jesus. but he did not understand the fullness of Christ's kingdom and its implications for the injustices in his community. Both Reverend Marsh and the civil rights workers were wrong, but in different ways. Reverend Marsh sought the king without the kingdom. The civil rights workers sought the kingdom without the king. The church needs a Christ-centered, fully orbed kingdom perspective to correctly answer the question, what would Jesus do? I think that part of what we have to do in recovering a kingdom perspective is learn the practice of mercy. And of course, this means, at least at a personal level, generosity. Generosity that, as C.S. Lewis said, if our charities do not at all pinch or hamper us, I should say they are too small. While affirming the good of affluence, after all, we wouldn't be helping poor people unless we believed in the good of affluence, we've got to be willing to give sacrificially ourselves. It's a kingdom practice. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Charles Murray's work. You know, Murray's done a lot of sociology kind of work through the years. He did The Bell Curve. He did Losing Ground. His new book is called Coming Apart. And I haven't read the book yet, but I've heard him talk about it, and I've read some interaction with it. And it's really interesting. He divides up, he's really just focusing on white America. And he divides white America up into Belmont, which is sort of the upper class, upper crust, wealthier group, and Fishtown, which is poor America, those who are not as well educated and not as well off. And he says the gap between rich and poor is widening. And he says that in his studies, what he's found, and I'm not saying he would put it exactly the way I'm going to put it here, but this is how I think it's most useful for us to understand it. The gap between rich and poor now is largely a matter of ethics, which is, of course, largely a matter of religion. And so the lesson from his research seems to be this. The best way to help the poor is to get them into church. Those in Belmont are far more likely to attend church. And the way to help the poor is to help them not have children out of wedlock, get married, and raise children together as a couple. That is the single greatest key to prosperity, is holding the family together. But in Fishtown, they're not getting married, and they're having children, but obviously having children out of wedlock. And when they do get married, it very often ends in divorce. The stability of the family is tied to prosperity. Divorce and illegitimacy create a downward spiral of poverty. But what he goes on to say is Belmont, you know, sort of has this figured out. You know, you don't have the kind of illegitimacy rates, you don't have the divorce rates, people are getting married, that kind of thing. But nobody in Belmont is doing anything to help Fishtown. And so kind of his summation of it all is this message to Belmont: you need to preach what you practice. You need to let Fishtown in on the secret. It's being in church, it's holding your family together. Those are the keys to economic prosperity. And I think he's exactly right about that. And so I think we have to ask in our churches, what are we doing to build families, especially among the poor? And you might, you know, you talk about politics. I read the story about changing, you know, the laws that were oppressing blacks in Mississippi. What about divorce laws? No-fault divorce laws that are a travesty and have done far more damage to the American family than gay marriage could do. I mean, we should oppose gay marriage, too, because that would be a disaster as well. But it's really no-fault divorce that has allowed the American family to unravel at such an unprecedented rate. What are we doing? What are we doing to disciple families so they can stay together, work through their problems, raise children together in an intact home? If you take away the father, I forget the statistic off the top of my head, but it's a huge multiple, the rate at which sons, male children, are likely to end up illiterate and in prison. You take away the father, sons, boys growing up have virtually no chance. That's the kind of thing we've got to address. If we believe the kingdom touches everything, the kingdom touches the family, it transforms the family, what does that mean? Let me talk about one more area as quickly as I can. We've got to learn to live out our faith in our vocations. We've got to learn to understand what it means to carry out our vocations under the lordship of Christ. We've got to learn to reshape our career fields to bring them under the lordship of Christ. We've got to have a vision for the workplace, a kingdom vision. We've got to understand that workers are ministers too. Workers are missionaries. The early church saw this, and we've got to see it as well. Every legitimate vocation is to be offered to Christ as a form of service to Him. That is to say, there is no secular sacred dichotomy. Now, that's not news to most evangelical Christians today to say there's no sacred secular dichotomy. But here's the thing. Many Christians will pay lip service to that. There's no secular sacred dichotomy. And then go out and live in their vocation and live in the world just like non-Christians do, with no discernible difference in how they carry out their vocation. So we may have that theology in our heads, but in practice we're still failing to live an integrated life. We've got to learn to see our work as an aspect of our mission. We've got to learn to see business as a form of mission. We've got to integrate our faith into our work and our work into our faith. We've got to learn to do our work and develop businesses with kingdom priorities and kingdom perspectives in view. We've got to learn to see how our work can actually be a form of prayer, an extension of prayer, a form of worship. Leslie Newbegin is so helpful here. Listen to how, this is a real challenge, Stuart, you'll find this very challenging. This is how he describes the task of the pastor, the task of pastors in training lay people in their congregation to serve in their fields Christianly, because they're the ones who are really out on the front lines. Listen to what he says. The task of the ministry is to lead the congregation as a whole in a mission to the community as a whole, to claim its whole public life as well as the personal lives of all its people for God's rule. It means equipping all the members of the congregation to understand and fulfill their several roles in this mission through faithfulness in their daily work. It means training and equipping them to be active followers of Jesus in his assault on the principalities and powers which he disarmed on the cross. And it means sustaining them and bearing the cost of that warfare. The minister is not like a general who sits at the headquarters and sends his troops out into battle. Rather, he goes at their head and takes the brunt of enemy attack. He enables and encourages them by leading them, not just by telling them. In this picture, the words of Jesus have quite a different force. They all find their meaning in the central key words, follow me. And then listen to how Newbegin, this is from an article where Newbegin's words are used to answer a series of questions. How could the gospel be communicated now that we are in what has become a foreign culture? In other words, now that we live in a culture that is no longer as receptive to the gospel, how can we communicate the gospel? Newbegin says, the only hermeneutic of the gospel is a congregation of men and women who believe it and live by it. That is, the only way the world can interpret what the gospel is really about is if they see us living out the truths of the gospel in our everyday lives. So he says we need to be prepared for and sustained in the exercise of our priesthood in the world. Where does this priesthood of believers function? It is in the ordinary secular business of the world that the sacrifices of love and obedience are to be offered to God. It is in the context of secular affairs that this mighty power is released into the world through the work of Christ. The church gathers every Sunday to renew its participation in Christ's priesthood. But the exercise of this priesthood is not within the walls of the church, but in the daily business of the world. How can this priesthood of believers be equipped to represent Christ's work in the world? The congregation has to be a place where its members are trained, supported, and nourished in the exercise of their parts of the priestly ministry in the world. The preaching and teaching of the local church has to be such that it enables members to think out the problems that face them in their secular work in light of their Christian faith. And I think far too few of our churches take seriously this task of training God's people to live as God's priesthood in the world, in their secular affairs, in their in the secular workplace. We are called to live seamless lives, integrated lives, where everything we do reflects the lordship of Christ, including how we work, and we've got to think that through. Dick Doster has written a very helpful article on this where he talks about at great length what this looks like and how business can become an agent of the kingdom, how the workplace, it's not just a mission field to share the gospel with others, but a place where you can actually do good for the kingdom, where you're actually doing the king's work in the workplace. And he ends his article this way. He says that He talks about how Christian artists have gotten a great deal of attention. Christian artists add beauty and complexity to God's creation, transforming the raw materials of paint, language, and sound into finished products that proclaim God's glory. But then he asks, where are their counterparts in the business world? Christian businessmen, Christian men in the working world who are learning to do the same. He says, where are the entrepreneurs and the corporate executives who with the same passion reshape the world through business? And who intentionally and for the sake of God's glory manage the power of free markets to make the world more productive? Where are the Christians who are propelling the world's best corporations? God's people can, as agents of his redemptive plan, transform business, stripping it of selfish ambition and pursuing instead what's best for their neighbors. Through business, God's people can harness mankind's creativity and with it nurture his creation, developing products that make the world more satisfying. Through the economic power of commerce, Christians can make the world safer and healthier. The members of Christ's church, distributed in offices around the world, can transform greed into good stewardship, showing the world that business has a biblical responsibility to create new wealth and provide a fair return to investors. But with an eye toward the consummation of Christ's kingdom, we also create wealth in order to create new and satisfying jobs, which offer the hope and perhaps a glimpse of a coming world where there is no poverty. Christian business is really the only answer to poverty in the world, because what poor people need is money. The church doesn't